Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
First, we're in depth on the lingering double bind. I've had Kathleen Hall Jameson's excellent book, Beyond the Double Bind, on my bookshelf since it came out in 1995. The week that Hillary Clinton accepted the Democratic nomination for president, I pulled it off the shelf and I flipped through the pages I'd marked when I first read it. And I came to a chapter titled Hillary Clinton as Rorschach Test. Hall Jameson wrote, "Hillary Clinton became a surrogate on whom we projected our attitudes about attributes once thought incompatible." We're going to expand on that today in our discussion. I think Kathleen Hall Jameson and I would like to hear from you, too, as we talk about this wider issue of women as leaders and the double bind. So, do you think as women, we still face that double bind of leadership, that we're criticized for being too assertive and too confident, perceived as ineffective if we're not? Now, it's more complicated than that, and we're going to talk about why that is. But I think you understand what I'm talking about this morning, and I'd like to hear from women first today on this. Men, we'll take your calls a little later in the hour, but women, I'd really like to hear what you have to say. I think Kathleen would, too. Do you think as women, we still face this idea of the double bind of leadership, too assertive, too confident, criticized as such, but perceived as ineffective if we're not? We're going to tease that out a bit more in the conversation here. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I've tweeted out a question on this. It's at Carrie NPR. And Steph Curtis is hanging out at nprnews.org/live. Kathleen Hall Jameson is a professor of communication at the Annenberg School at the University of Pennsylvania. She's the author of many books, including the one that we're talking about today, Beyond the Double Bind, Women and Leadership. And she's with us today from Philadelphia. Kathleen, welcome. I'm really glad you could be part of the show today.
It's great to be with you.
So let's come back to the Hillary Clinton Rorschach test that you wrote about 20 years ago. She was the first lady when your book was published, years before she would serve in the U.S. Senate and run for president. And I have to say, what you wrote then is so relevant to today. You said, you write about how a pollster for Time magazine asked respondents whether they agreed that Hillary Clinton, quote, doesn't pay enough attention to her family. And you point out that she was often seen as tough, a whisper away from the condemnatory hard and hard-edged. You must see the echoes today from what you were writing in 1995.
Yes, and I actually see something else that is troubling. If you remember the famous cookies and tea comment,
yes. Right.
In its original context, what Hillary Clinton was saying was she didn't see why she should stay home and bake cookies and tea. And the referent is, while her husband is governor, and at that point they are childless. The rest of the sentence says, rather than fulfill my profession, which I started before he entered public life, I'm paraphrasing. The rest of that sentence, in other words, situates this as a choice between her exercising her professional credentials or not while he's governor. It has nothing to do with stay-at-home mothers. It's asking whether she should be a hostess to a governor. In the last week, we have seen two different articles in the New York Times which interpreted that comment without quoting the full comment as an attack at stay-at-home mothers.
Wow. You know, I don't want to miss this thing that I noted about the Time magazine poll question either, because I actually think they could rephrase that a bit, and it would be the same kind of thing that would be asked today. And in 95, or before that, Time magazine was asking whether Clinton didn't pay enough attention to her family. What are these assumptions behind that question?
Well, originally, the double bind that women face, the first one that I defined in the book was called uterus brain. That is, you can exercise your uterus or you can exercise your brain, but you can't use both. And literally, the idea was, they argued it physiologically, that the brain was the capacities of the brain were drawn away when you were engaging in reproduction and childbearing and child rearing. And the way that double bind was debunked was women finally got into the sciences and they did experiments such as this. They took women who were menstruating and women who weren't, women who were carrying children and women who weren't, men who were menstruating. No, isn't that a joke? No, men as the comparison group, because obviously they weren't childbearing or menstruating, but they were the comparison, and they had them do mathematical equations. And what they found was there was no difference between women who were menstruating and not, women who were in the process of bearing children or not, and men on their capacity to calculate. These women literally debunked the double bind by showing the brain still worked.
Amazing. Let me grab a call here from Jamie in St. Paul. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Of course. Tell me what you're thinking about.
There was a book that I read a number of years ago that really stuck with me called Cinderella Ate My Daughter.
I think that's Peggy Ornstein, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's a beautiful book. And while it's not the point of the book, it does address this same concept. And I think it does so beautifully, just in remarking, you know, as a parent trying to raise a daughter, how you encourage her to be herself while she's trying to walk the balance between these different traits, these opposing traits, and all the kind of perfectionism she's expected to have on both sides of the aisle.
Yeah, I think you're hearing what Kathleen said in 95 about how we projected all of these attitudes about, I think, Kathleen, as you put it, attributes once thought incompatible. What were you thinking about?
Well, when I originally put the concept of double bind into this framework, what I was arguing was that these things that historically, long times ago, had said, for example, it's either uterus or brain, we got rid of. Women got into the workforce, but there's a residue of those in the way in which we think about women. And so we are always asking, is a woman doing everything we expect her to do as a woman? And then in addition, is she doing everything we expect her to do in the job? There's a dual frame around the woman. And there's the assumption that's implicit that somehow there's a trade-off. You can't do both, but you have to do both. And you can't do both, so you can't be successful.
So you can't be an effect. This is how the logic goes. You can't be an effective and loving and empathetic mother if you're spending part of your time in the professional world, because something has to suffer for that, and that's the role that we expect of you as mother. Is that how it goes?
Yes, and notice there's no mention of what we expect of the father.
Right.
And so the frame that we ought to be looking at is, how do we parent in a society in which we don't have a society if we don't have offspring? So there's a social good associated with parenting and having children. And we should be asking, how do we create a work environment that makes it possible for both men and women to be good parents and also to be effective in the workplace?
A call here from Sean in Minneapolis. Hi, Sean.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning. What are you thinking about?
Well, I got a lot of things I'm thinking about, but I totally agree that the conversation hasn't changed about the woman, you know, the professional woman, and always trying to pit us against the stay-at-home mom. You know, and I think another thing that we can add into this conversation that we face is that if there's any personal indiscretions in our life, they're more than willing to come after us on those, but they wouldn't come after a man candidate. Because, you know, the whole Clinton story is standing by the man. But on the other hand, we have the social conversation going across our societies is that how do we keep these marriages together? We know kids suffer. We know offspring suffer. So that dual parent is important. But we don't always value it when someone actually does repair a marriage and does go forward.
Yeah, I think, Kathleen, she's talking about a lot of what has been said about the Clintons, right?
Well, and let's do a thought experiment. Let's say, imagine that Bill and Hillary Clinton sent Chelsea away to boarding school while we were watching them in public life, and then Hillary Clinton runs for president. What would we say about Hillary Clinton? Well, Donald Trump sent his children away from boarding school, and we're not talking about that at all. And by the way, they seem to be lovely adults.
One of the things that you write of women in general on the double bind of femininity and competence, she is too strident, and this is not about Clinton. This is, again, women in general that have to confront this. She is too strident and abrasive, or not aggressive or tough enough, or alternatively, she has succumbed to the disabling effects of the feminine stereotype of emotionalism. And my note on that was, this hasn't changed. It hasn't changed in politics. I don't know that it's changed very much in corporate America. What have you observed about it?
Well, first, the underlying double bind historically is what I called silent shame. Women weren't allowed in the public sphere, and those who moved into the public sphere initially were identified as prostitutes. They were discredited. They were inappropriate women. And as a result, we have developed a vocabulary around female speech and male speech over a long period of time that's fundamentally different. You don't use the word strident about a male. You don't talk about a male being shrill. In the last election, not this election, that Hillary Clinton ran, you saw Hillary Clinton in 2008, at that point the front runner, running against Rudolph Giuliani, also at that point the front runner. And they both had an odd pattern of laughter. They would pause after a question, so not laugh immediately, and then laugh. And the laugh was interesting. It was somewhat different in both of them. Hers was described as a cackle. His wasn't even noteworthy. We are more likely to observe the language patterns of a woman and to cast them pejoratively, in part because we have a range of vocabulary available to describe them that is pejorative and nothing to describe the same signals as positive, and we feature them with women, not men. The New York Times actually ran an article, and I'm featuring the New York Times because most people would think of its editorial page as liberal, and hence you'd assume more enlightened. And so this is now my second negative New York Times example for the day. Apologies to New York Times, but they actually ran an article which called it a cackle. They also, by the way, at the end of the 2008 election, in their retrospective, wrote a piece that said she didn't pass the commander-in-chief test. Mm. Well, the assumption about a woman is she can't pass the commander-in-chief test, in part because for a long period of time we didn't let women serve in the military at all, and military service was a credential to run for public office. But the wrap-up piece that said she didn't pass the commander-in-chief test was defied by a New York Times survey reported earlier in that year that showed, oh, yes, she had more than 50% of the electorate thought she was perfectly competent as commander-in-chief. That was an instance of a reporter who didn't check the evidence but just assumed that must have been why she failed.
You know, I think this is something that we can talk about Trump in a minute, but I also think this is something that Reince Priebus, the GOP chair, either instinctively understands or he's looking at polling, you know, which is adding some confirmation for him. Because after that NBC candidates forum, the commander in chief forum, he tweeted out Hillary Clinton was angry and defensive the entire time. No smile and uncomfortable. Seriously, can you imagine criticism for a male candidate for not smiling enough? I think that's the kind of thing that rides on the expectations of how women should be in a forum like that.
Can't control emotion. That's a stereotype, a long-lived stereotype. Why weren't women supposed to be able to get the vote? They can't control their emotions. They're not rational enough. Not smile. We focus on women's appearance differently, and we judge them through their appearance. Remember the comment by Rush Limbaugh a number of years ago that we don't really want to watch Hillary Clinton age in office and get wrinkled. Well, everyone is going to age in office or die, and they're going to wrinkle. Is there some problem with wrinkling? In which case, you know, we've got a problem for the male candidates too. And let's do another thought experiment, because when you talk about Hillary Clinton, there's a tendency for people to see this as if this is a political discussion, not a discussion about gender.
Right.
So let's go back to Sarah Palin. When Sarah Palin was speaking from the floor of the Republican convention at the podium and giving a fine, rousing speech, her child, a baby, was being passed from her daughter to her husband and back in the gallery, and the camera caught that. And a reporter on air commented about why the baby was there. Now, imagine a reversal. Suppose the husband had been giving the speech and Sarah Palin had passed the baby. No one would have said anything. The implicit assumption was that somehow she wasn't behaving appropriately in relationship to that baby, who by everything you could see was a perfectly happy, well-cared-for baby being lovingly cared for by a family. These assumptions about gender affect Republicans as well as Democrats. It isn't ideological. It's there.
And that's the point. As you tune in to listen to this conversation with Kathleen Hall Jamison, I want you to hear this as gender, not politics. We are not making political statements here, although, yes, we're talking a lot about people in the political arena. This is Gender, research-driven, observed, and written about by Kathleen Hall Jamison for years, going back to this 1995 book that I referenced called Beyond the Double Bind. And that's what we're discussing this morning. Do you think as women we still face that double bind of leadership? So we're criticized for being too assertive, too confident. I mean, there's recent studies that talk about what this is like for women in the workplace when you're perceived as too confident and assertive, or perceived as ineffective if we're not confident and assertive. Is this something that you've experienced in your own workplace, in your own social dealings, in your own personal interactions? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 to Portia in Minneapolis. Hey, Portia, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm a holistic healer and a health coach in town, and I work with a lot of women through a lot of age groups around this issue where they might be bumping up against not feeling competent in work or struggling with how they're perceived. And so we start to tease out the motivation, the difference in motivation between them wanting to please and be liked versus wanting to be respected.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk a lot about how that urge to please and be liked has to do with feeling safe in relationships, which, you know, comes back to a lot of gender stereotypes in our culture. And that when they start to move into being motivated about being respected, that has to do with power. And that can feel really uncomfortable for everything that you're talking about, because a lot of times they might start to get pushback and a lot of what I call guff being kind of flung at them.
Right. So, Portia, this is something that you're saying younger women, the millennials that you work with, the Gen Xers that you work with, are experiencing too.
Yeah, I do see it in terms of the people who are coming through my door, that there's levels across the age group. And I have seen that sometimes the Gen Xers or even some boomers, it almost is like the root runs a little deeper sometimes. And I wonder if that's just because of, you know, that especially the boomers were born in the 50s.
Yeah.
And so some of that real gender stereotypes are pretty, you know, they saw that really modeled in their parents. But I do see it with some of the younger women coming in too. And maybe that's just, you know, them really starting to step into their own power as they come into their own adulthood.
Yeah. Portia, thanks so much. Kathleen, what do you think?
The stereotypes change across time, and we're seeing change occurring. The number of women who are in the professoriate is increasing. The number of women on air is increasing. The number of women in all categories of leadership increasing. And as audiences see a wider range of women engaged in various behaviors, we will increasingly break down the assumption that women don't belong in some places. And all of that is extraordinarily important. And it's happening very, very rapidly. It's highly productive. But that doesn't mean that we don't still have some stereotypic assumptions. We have them, by the way, about age as well. And one of the things that's tricky about stereotypes is we don't know that they're affecting us. So the very people who are affected can be thinking that, no, they're seeing the world as it is and don't realize that filter is sitting there.
Right. I just had, this is fun. Steph, I don't know if you've looked at what I retweeted here from our friend Deb. She says, great site quoted by Mighty Girl, 9 non-threatening leadership strategies. And she says, this one is classic. And it shows a woman in a meeting with a man sitting next to her, and she's saying, yes, that's exactly what I said. And that's that's labeled as threatening. You know where this is going. Mm-hmm. Non-threatening. Thank you for articulating that so clearly. I mean, what? I mean, this kind of gets to that idea that you're in a meeting and, you just picked up on what I was saying there and how people react to that in the meeting, right?
Well, and I love the strategy in meetings by which women and men of goodwill repeat the comment and praise the comment for and credit the originator, particularly when a woman has just seen an idea usurped by someone else around the table whose idea it wasn't, because it's a way of subtly reminding people that there is some credit due here. One of the things that I think is stereotypic and that we make as an ongoing assumption is that men are allowed to take credit in different ways than women. And so when you hear someone who is trying to make a case for themselves, they have to tell you what they've done and why it's been important. But just as a thought experiment, imagine that Hillary Clinton took the type of credit for what she has done that Donald Trump takes. And now, isn't it more jarring than it is when you hear it from Trump? And part of what that thought experiment is designed to do is to say we are tolerating a kind of credit taking from the male that we would not accept from the female.
Yeah. So the thought experiment might say, I alone know how, this is Hillary Clinton, I alone know how to end the war with ISIS. I have a secret plan that but I know more than the general. I can't imagine any woman, even if she believed it, feeling like she could say it.
Yeah, and we're expected to be gender appropriate, to be self-effacing and to be relational, to give credit to many in an organization who deserve credit. But in that structure, we're also saying it's going to be harder to take credit for the things that actually are attributable to a person's leadership. And the way I try to work the thought experiment through, because I want to get ideology out of my thought experiment, is to say, would Margaret Thatcher have gotten away with saying some of the things that Donald Trump said? Because Margaret Thatcher has a very different kind of style and came from a different leadership tradition. There are some subtle differences in a culture that in which you've got Elizabeth Rex and Queen Victoria in your background, where what we have are women who did manage the presidency very artfully in difficult times. Edith Bowling Wilson, for example, but didn't really get credit.
Alyssa says, absolutely, about the double bind for women in leaders. She says, how to get out of it? Part of my big meeting prep is still the right smart but nice outfit, not just the content. And then Deb, who tweeted out that funny graphic, says, how can I stream this into my ear as I go into my next meeting? I need it during the meeting. Step off the page.
Nicole says, I work in higher ed and I face this every day. I've been called cold and aloof, quote, until you get to know me. She says, the hard part is that I find the more harsh negative comments come from other women in my professional sphere. I've been told that my laugh is too loud and that my work might be better received if I wore a little makeup. Chris says, women have a much more nurturing approach to leadership, which includes developing, inspiring, and motivating others. Relationship building, collaboration, and teamwork. These skills are often mislabeled as being emotional, soft-hearted, ineffective, and time-wasting. In the world today, there's a need for a leader to be more holistic in their decisions and motivations.
Do you think that was another woman that suggested that the first writer wear more
I think it might have been. Haven't you, like, imagine your mother's voice, like, you could use a little makeup. You look so tired today.
You're going to wear that?
I think it could be. I don't think any man would ever tell a woman you need a little makeup.
But let's step back and ask a question that has actually been phrased this year, which is, what does a president look like?
Exactly.
So when Donald Trump says that Hillary Clinton doesn't look like a president, I really want to know what he thinks a president should look like. I wonder if a president should have, say, yellow hair and an odd blowback look. I wonder if a president should be somewhat, say, portly. I wonder whether a president should wear a certain kind of tie and suit. Should it be an Armani, for example? Because none of them look to me like George Washington, so I don't think we're saying they should look like George Washington, and they shouldn't wear powdered wigs. I think what that is saying is, at least subtly and in part to some, can you imagine a woman who could ever look like a president?
I mean, Kathleen, I thought you were also going to mention what Donald Trump says about stamina. I think that's even more, and I believe that is why when Hillary Clinton felt, you know, that she should stay home and recover from pneumonia, she didn't feel like she could, because he has questioned her stamina. There's real gender stuff going on there, too, isn't there?
Yeah, and the fact that he has used that as a critique for men as well as women is interesting.
That's right. That
because
is true.
We stereotypes are activated in different ways in different contexts. And also, we don't all hold the same stereotypes. So some audiences may hear something one way, some another. But historically, the backdrop for women is the argument that women are frail.
Right.
Women need to be protected. One of the arguments for making sure that women were able to stay in the home, which was always kind of silly because there were women who are working in factories and on farms during this period doing extremely difficult, long hours of very hard work. But nonetheless, the notion of the frail flower woman is still somewhat there, and we're supposed to protect them. Now, in that context, you will hear the same charge, no stamina, low energy, differently when it is attacking Jeb Bush as opposed to attacking Hillary Clinton, because there's some stereotypic assumptions available when you're talking about a woman as opposed to a man.
Step off the page.
Yeah, Julia made a comment at nprnews.org/live that I wanted to get on in time for people to call in about. She says, I'm interested in the triple bind or quadruple bind that women of color face in the workplace and society. One criticism of the book Lean In is that it encourages women to be more assertive, but women of color, especially black women, are judged even more harshly when they're assertive. The assertiveness is seen as aggressive because of stereotypes of black women.
So, Kathleen, the triple bind then for women of color?
And quadruple bind, because add aging to that.
Oh, right.
And now you've got a real, really complex situation. Yes, and here is the way ultimately we're going to break through these stereotypes. We're going to have so many women who are different in talent and style and temperament that we're not going to say there's one cutout vision of what constitutes leadership when you are a woman. But rather, the person who has a more nurturant style and the person who has a less nurturant style are both going to be acceptable models of leadership. There is, by the way, occasionally a negative tag to men who are too far over on the nurturing end of the continuum as well.
Well, I think President Obama has been criticized for that, hasn't he? I mean, remember the reaction. You and I may have talked about this, the reaction when he said presidents need to be more empathetic.
Mm-hmm. And you also periodically have he's not masculine enough.
Right.
So you hear the charge against George Herbert Walker Bush when he was first running for president in the primaries, in which the commentary said his voice is too high pitched. In other words, he doesn't have enough testosterone. He's not male enough to be president. So there are stereotypes that are available to attack masculinity, too. They just aren't as prevalent, as widespread. And there also are enough alternative male models out there that one individual male is less likely to put it in some single box.
Hey, if you're getting a busy signal, that's because we've got full phone lines. I do want to hear from you. Call us back. And if you can get on the conversation with Steph at nprnews.org/live, great. Tweet me. It's at Carrie NPR to Amy in Wilmer. Hi, Amy. Thanks so much for waiting. Hi.
Good morning.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about yourself.
I am an ordained pastor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm about in my mid-40s, and I've run into this experience of some congregation members or community members feel that it's okay to comment on what I wear to church, how my children behave in church, and I don't think they would do that to a male pastor. I mean, it's even been commented on if I tear up during a hymn or a particular part of a worship service. I get called on the carpet for that, for being too emotional.
How do you handle this?
Well, I don't typically push back as far as to question whether they would address a male pastor that way. But I do talk to them about being in relationship with other people and how we all are human. And this is my humanity coming out, that if I'm emotional, it's because I'm human. And if I, you know, my clothing choices are mine, not anyone else's. And it opens up a little bit of conversation, but at first blow, it is very jarring.
I'll bet. Yeah.
And this is the experience of women who are in a first situation. So a congregation that is experiencing a female pastor now is having its first experience. Now, the second person who is a woman who comes, the third, is going to have an easier time because the range has opened up. And so the reason I'm hopeful is that as we break into new areas and people get more experience, it starts to wear down the stereotypes. They start to see the person as opposed to the stereotypes, and that shift takes place. But it's a very difficult moment when you're the first in that situation. I can remember being told that there really was a uniform that was expected of female college professors. And one of the things you did not ever do was wear slacks. And of course, I was also the first pregnant woman who was in tenure track in my university, and was told that, well, you need to be careful about what you wear. You don't want to feature the pregnancy. The implication being that at the point at which I started to be demonstrably pregnant, that is, other people could tell this, perhaps it might be appropriate to take a leave. Well, it was
God,
the first time they'd had a woman in that situation. And so I also was told as I was being considered for my next high level appointment in academia, that I didn't have or the question was, did I have the portion of a male anatomy that's probably not polite to mention in a Minnesota public radio? Did she have the fill in the blank in order to handle a job that required raising funds? So now notice the metaphor there is in terms of male anatomy. And I can tell you the answer was categorically no, I did not have that part of the male anatomy. But nonetheless, I thought that that was completely irrelevant to whether or not I could do the job. And so you had the assumption of male definition contextualizing an evaluation of whether a woman would be able to hold a job. Now, we're way past that.
Yeah. Although you tell this story, I thought you were going to tell the story at the end of your book, Beyond the Double Bind, about being at that University of Maryland night school class about public speaking.
Yes.
And one of the male students came up to you afterwards and said, you weren't what he expected. Do you remember what he said to you?
Yeah. I love this man because this was a night course, which is the most satisfying teaching. These are people who have worked a long day and they're picking up skills at the end of the night in order to get their next promotion. It's a public speaking course. And he worked in a garbage truck. A very, very large, charming man. But he was completely bewildered by the fact that I was pregnant. And he asked me, how did you get pregnant? How did that happen? And of course, the answer is, well, there's a sperm. And this for him was an entirely new encounter. Now, you know, he went on to do well in the class. I was a first experience for him. I assume the next time a pregnant woman was in a professional position, he didn't ask that question.
He also told you he thought you were going to have a beard when he signs up.
Yep.
So your name must have read something like K. Hall Jameson or something on the sign-up sheet, right?
It actually read K. H. Jameson.
Okay.
So. Because this was back when they were still typing things into boxes. We didn't really have the ability to digitize anything, and I have a long last name. So I lost Hall, and it was K.H. Jameson. I think he thought maybe he was going to get a Kevin.
Joanne and Chanhassen called to say she ran for office. She had an editorial writer say she was ungracious in the way that she ran her campaign. In her legal career, she's also been expected to be gracious and criticized when she's not. And step off the page.
Heather says, saying that women have a much more nurturing approach to leadership is a huge stereotype, just like saying all men are decisive. And setting the expectation that women are supposed to be more nurturing makes those of us who aren't so soft in our approach have others look at us like we are. I'm not going to say the word. It starts with a B. And Anya says, I run a manufacturing company where women in leadership are not well represented. Interestingly, when I was brought in 3 years ago, there were concerns if I could be tough enough to turn the facility around. When I asked what that means, I was just told, people expect you to be nice.
Yeah.
Interesting, Anya wrote. She says, glad to report we won Best Facility Award within a year.
Kathleen Hall Jameson is with us. If you've just tuned into the conversation, we're talking about the double bind of leadership. Yes, you hear us talking a lot about the political arena, of course, because Hillary Clinton is running for president. But this is a show about gender stereotyping and expectations and beliefs. It's really not about the politics of this. And we're looking back to a book that I've had since it came out in 1995, Kathleen's book, Beyond the Double Bind, Women in Leadership, and saying, is some of what appeared to be true then true today? And I think this conversation proves that out, that yes, a lot of it remains believed without a lot of evidence to support it. That's my tactful way of saying that. 651-227-6000 to tell me about your experience with the double bind as a leader in your social interactions, in your workplace. 800-242-2828 on Twitter, as always, at Carrie NPR. We'll get a look at the latest news. We'll continue the conversation. John, what are you watching this hour?
Carrie, the Obama administration is setting a goal to take in 110,000 refugees from around the world in the coming year. That's according to a senior administration official. The target, an increase of 25,000 from the previous year when the U.S. goal was 85,000. It reflects continuing concern about the refugee crisis stemming from Syria's civil war and other conflicts. Secretary of State John Kerry briefed lawmakers on the goal yesterday. Obama plans to host a summit on refugee issues next week at the U.N. General Assembly gathering in New York. The mayor of Flint, Michigan, is not happy that Donald Trump is planning to visit her city as that city deals with its water contamination crisis. Karen Weaver, who is a Democrat, says the Trump campaign has not offered any help and did not consult her before making plans to visit today. She says in a statement that the city is, quote, focused on fixing the problems caused by lead contamination of our drinking water, not photo ops. The Republican nominee's campaign said Trump is planning to tour a water plant and discuss the crisis. A British nurse who contracted Ebola while working in Sierra Leone has been cleared of misconduct charges. The Nursing and Midwifery Council said today after a two-day hearing that Pauline Cafferkey had not conducted herself improperly. The council had scheduled the hearing because of allegations that Cafferkey concealed her elevated temperature from health officials when she returned to Britain in December of 2014 after a stint in West Africa treating Ebola victims. Stocks opening slightly higher on Wall Street, led by gains in technology and healthcare companies. Apple, Twitter, and Netflix all showing healthy gains. The Dow up just under 0.5%. The Nasdaq up 0.75%. The S&P 500 up 0.5%. This is Minnesota Public Radio News.
Later on All Things Considered, thousands of protesters from across the country are trying to stop the construction of a North Dakota pipeline.
There's no planet B. Once you screw this one up, you can't fix it.
I'm Tom Cran. Join me for that and all the day's news starting at 3.
I've heard from a lot of you via email about an interview that I did earlier this week with Max Porter about his new novel, Grief is the Thing with Feathers. If you missed it, you can find it, as with all of the shows I do, on the podcast. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller in iTunes.
Programming supported by the Bailey Group, shaping extraordinary people into transformational leaders who build successful teams and thriving organizations. More about CEO advising and executive team coaching at thebaileygroup.com/CEO.
Back to our conversation now. Kathleen Hall Jamison with us. She's director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of many books. I have Beyond the Double Bind, Women in Leadership in front of me. It came out in 95, and we're talking about Kathleen, I should ask you about this. Could you have imagined that much of what you were raising and writing about in 1995 is still so relevant because it still happens?
I'm surprised by it. I had assumed that because women were moving into leadership positions and more women were moving through the academic track, so we were seeing higher proportions of women getting undergraduate degrees, that the change in those kinds of assumptions would have been more rapid than it has been. But that said, I don't want to underestimate the extent to which there has been change. When I first came into the academy, there was no protection. If you were pregnant, you could be fired on the job. There are legal protections in place that were not there now. And part of what that is doing, we didn't have Title IX. Now we have Title IX. Look at all the female athletes we just celebrated at the Olympics. We've made real progress. But the assumptions are deeply rooted, and we're not aware of them, and that makes it harder to get rid of them.
You know, I was reading something that Deborah Tannen wrote in the Washington Post in February, how this applies to younger women. And this is interesting because we're hearing from a number of younger women today. She wrote, "The double bind lowers its boom on women in positions of authority. So those who haven't yet risen to such positions have not yet felt its full weight. They may well believe," and Deborah adds, "as I did when I was young, that when the time comes, they'll be judged fairly based on their qualifications. They probably have not yet experienced the truism that to get equal consideration, a woman has to be better than her male counterparts." Do you concur with that?
I think there's an additional insight available on why this perpetuates itself and people are not aware of it. Often it exercises itself out of the view of the person who is being categorized. I served as the dean for 14 years. I saw student evaluations of male and female professors. I watched them in the classroom. I knew how well they taught. The female was evaluated differently in enough situations for me to think that there's a gender bias against the female professor, largely based on assumptions that she is going to be more accessible than the male and a penalty if she is not. And she's going to have more relational skills. There's a warm, cold dimension that appears in those evaluations that isn't present to the same extent, sometimes at all, in the male evaluations. Now, does the female college professor see those evaluations in those terms? Mm. No, because she never sees the male's evaluations. Mm-hmm. So she can assume that the male is getting those as well. As dean, I knew the male wasn't.
Yeah. Abby, I think, is speaking to this in a way. She says on Twitter, almost every time I hear a leader described as charismatic, they're male. People view women and passion in speaking as emotional. And to the phones here to Caitlin in Minneapolis. Hi, Caitlin. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hey,
Caitlin. Yeah, go right ahead.
So I've been listening very interested because I've watched this happen in my role. So I'm in my upper 20s and I've risen fairly quickly in a local healthcare company here into mm-hmm. a director role.
Mm-hmm.
And good position. I love it. Great company. Very flexible. My husband and I had a baby a year ago and it's been wonderful. But one thing that's been really interesting to watch is the number of times I'll be told by both male and female colleagues that I should, not worry about that night meeting because I have a baby at home and I should be with them. Or, take the day off. It's his birthday. You don't need to be here. And it's a little bit demeaning because I can make that decision for myself.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And no one says that to my husband.
Right. So the caretaking.
They think they're well-meaning.
Exactly. I was going to say, these are probably good-intentioned people that don't realize that you're going to hear this in a way that says, I'll make the decisions. Thank you. Kathleen,
yes,
do you want to?
Absolutely.
Have this affecting people in hiring and they don't see the process by which it is ultimately discriminatory. And so faced with a young woman of childbearing age who is newly married, for example, against a male who is exactly the same age and is exactly the situation, that is childbearing age and married, although you certainly could imagine someone having children who is not married. But let's just set the situation up as a thought experiment. Is there in the hiring process the question, will I get the level of commitment out of the female candidate that I will out of the male candidate? And to the extent that there is discrimination, because we should assume that the male candidate is going to be as dedicated to family and use the same kinds of time equations or calculuses in making that decision as the female. But we don't, because we still make assumptions that it's the woman's job to engage in child rearing.
Steph, off the page.
Yeah, I just want to note that Paula is driving around her 10-year-old granddaughter mm-hmm. right now and is very appreciative of having this conversation on the radio.
Good.
Annie says, I won't forget the moment I returned to work after maternity leave with my second child. I'm a nurse practitioner in a busy critical care unit. A male physician colleague looked at me bewildered and said, but who is home caring for your child? This would have never been asked of a male counterpart. And Jackie says, jeez. And I like this comment a lot. She says, I'm a college student studying mechanical engineering. And while I consider myself a feminist, even I find myself mentally criticizing my female professors and classmates more harshly than the males. It seems this double bind is so firmly socially constructed that it's nested itself as second nature. Breaking this sort of habit requires active forward thinking and an intentional effort to create changes in perception.
This is a good thing to put to Kathleen, then. Breaking the habit, Kathleen, among we women and beyond that.
Well, that's the reason why it's important to become aware of it and become consciously aware so that when we see it, we actually recognize it. And we recognize it, we ask how it is we can minimize the likelihood that it's active, get rid of it, get it reframed, and create a social context for others in which that awareness is there as well. Because if you're not aware of it, you can't act on it. And so to the extent that we haven't been talking about this issue intelligently in this campaign and didn't talk about it intelligently when we had Sarah Palin on the national stage, we are missing an opportunity to become aware in ways that would minimize the likelihood that the stereotypes would persist.
Elizabeth and Egan called to say, I was recently laid off. I'm the mother of two. More people have said to me, oh, what a great opportunity. Now you can stay home with the kids. There's an assumption that suddenly losing my job is a gift for me to stay home. Very condescending. And to Tracy in Hugo. Hi, Tracy.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I just want to start by introducing myself as a woman who has worked in manufacturing for the last 24 years in a leadership role running a company. Mm-hmm. And that's an industry that I am in where probably only 5% of the workforce is female. And I think that in this particular time with all of the comments in the news media, people just generally talking about it, I feel a lot of angst and a very heightened awareness of comments that people are making about women, about what I might be wearing, about what I might be saying, whether or not I look tired on any given day. And I'm wondering how that might be affecting other women in similar positions, because it is so much conversation about it right now.
Yeah, what a great point to bring up. Kathleen, I think the awareness is positive, but as Tracy suggests, it's pretty uncomfortable. And then the question, and then what do you do about it?
Yeah, and the women who are working in sectors in which they are still in a minority are still on the front lines. They're still breaking stereotypes in a place that people are confronting for the first time, all sorts of stereotypes that they've had and they haven't had to address them. So I know it's uncomfortable to have these things raised. It's good to have these things raised because it's the awareness that ultimately produces the change. But being on the front line in one of those situations is not very comforting to say, well, you're part of the change process. You're doing something really important. Nonetheless, you are. It is. And those conversations are valuable. The question is when somebody says, gee, you're looking really tired. Are you all right? Are they asking the same questions about men who look tired? Is this really the frailty assumption coming through? And then how does one suggest that, oh, we're all working really hard and I bet we're all tired today, as a way of reframing to see whether somebody else looks just as tired but happens to be male is probably a good strategy.
Kathleen, as I was thinking about kind of the arc of this conversation, I was remembering that when Donald Trump suggested that or said that Hillary Clinton was playing the woman card, her response to that was to kind of confront it directly, but use humor. So you'll hear her say, if caring about childcare is playing the woman card, deal me in. And I thought even her response, and probably to use humor is the right way to do that. But think about how she had to calibrate the way she was going to answer that. If she came at it too directly and just said, and said some of the things that we're saying here today, imagine the fallout from that. She's had to figure out how to answer that in a way that's acceptable.
Yeah, and some of these phrases don't have meaning that we all share. So when someone says, play the woman card, exactly what does that mean? We've had some odd discussions this year. People should not, I think, in my world at least, be saying, I will vote for a person because he is a man or she is a woman. But one also should not say, I will vote against a person because he is a man or she is a woman. When we can get past having to say that out loud, then we are in an environment in which gender is not acting for or against anyone. The problem right now is the stereotypes work against the female candidate. We saw this, by the way, when Elizabeth Dole ran as well. I wish she had run longer and become a nominee, because we had a very interesting study going of the ways in which Republicans and Democrats focused on her appearance as well as her substance. But when they were asked whether they would vote for her in relationship to a male candidate, ideology was what dictated the vote, not perceptions of gender.
We've heard from a lot of women this morning, and I'm really happy about that. Maybe we let a man come into this conversation, to Hank in New York Mills. Hi, Hank.
Oh.
You're the token man male voice in this. Just
well,
teasing you.
You're going to like my argument. I think that there's a huge generalization out there that might cost Hillary Clinton the presidency. And that is, I think that our public demands that a woman in a position of power be likable. And I don't think they demand that from a man. I think we've had many presidents who are not necessarily likable, but were respected, and they went on to be good or great presidents. I don't think they give the same grace to a female. I think in order for a female to be respected in a position of power, they demand that she be likable.
Yeah, Kathleen.
It's very unfair.
Yeah, Hank, this is an interesting idea. I mean, I'm thinking, Kathleen, about what was said about George W. Bush, about is he the kind of guy you'd want to go out and have a beer with? You hear that raised with some male candidates.
Yeah, there have been male candidates penalized for the perception that they're not accessible and likable. But I think that your caller is onto something that's important, because to the extent that we assume that women are supposed to be warmer because of gender, women are supposed to be more concerned with relationships because of gender, women are, as a result, supposed to be the tenders of a sphere in which we feel that we're interpersonal space because of gender, then likability, although it can affect men, probably is a stronger criterion in voting. It's probably weighted more so with women than with men.
Steph, off the page.
Sarah says, as I progress in my career, I've found a different bias. Well-meaning older male colleagues worry that they are overburdening me, or they don't sign me up for an additional duty because I might be overwhelmed balancing the demands. But my male colleagues who are at the same point in their career are never offered that same consideration. It's been hard to combat, but I'm learning to speak up about my goals and what I think I can handle.
So, Kathleen, are you running some experiments this time around with Hillary Clinton? It seems like it would be an excellent atmosphere for that.
Yeah, we're not, and I actually wish we were.
Yeah.
But I had a choice on how to use resources, and I put them this year into trying to understand how the public is learning about the Zika virus, which disproportionately affects women and has catastrophic consequences.
Kathleen, really a pleasure to have you here today. I'm so glad you were available to talk about that 1995 book and then what it means for today. So thank you.
It's so good to be with you again.
I want to hear from Stephanie here as we close our conversation in Eden Prairie. Stephanie, what do you want to say?
Yes, I was just wanted to comment. I think a lot of it has to do with women tearing other women down, the uterus versus the brain. I am currently a stay-at-home mom. I have been for the last 10 years. But previous to that, the 20 years before that, I was actually working at a very, very high level in state government in Arizona. And I never had a lot of problems with the male colleagues that I had, but the women would often be more subjective towards me and not in agreement, taking me into less of an account. But now what I have found that since I have decided to stay home and raise my children, the people who tear me down the most generally tend to be the women who have not had a career.
So you mean
not take into account that I have a master's degree, a degree from a women's college, that I have traveled around the world.
Right.
They look at me and say, oh, she's just a stay-at-home mom. So I think, and if you offer an opinion, it's, oh, she's just a stay-at-home mom. It doesn't matter any longer. And I find that the women who have done nothing but stay home have said, well, you worked, you should know better. Or the women who do still work say, well, now you're just a stay-at-home mom. I find that women tear each other down across the board, dependent upon what they're doing in their life, and that there is no right decision for either side.
Stephanie, I'm glad you were listening to the show today. Thanks so much for the call. And Steph, one more thought here.
Let's wish Erin luck. She's interviewing for jobs in academia this spring. She says she's 7 months pregnant. She says, I wish it were true that being pregnant wouldn't change anything, but I know going in that I will have to be perfect if I want to be chosen over other candidates. Good luck, Erin.
Nothing seems complete. I stand up and I'm searching for the better part of me.
This is Alicia Keys, Superwoman. You can read more about Kathleen Hall Jamison's book on The Thread.
So much. State of humanity.
What's up?
Wearing on my shoulders. Yeah. Gotta find strength in me.
Programming is supported by Great River Energy, providing reliable electric service to 28 Minnesota member co-ops with a diverse mix of power generation, including power plants and renewable energy. Great River Energy, powering what's possible.